The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
That was just Moon Cassette by Narcisse out on our label, who is run by Travis Hayden, who is sitting to the left of me.
Hello.
You are listening to Snacky Tunes coming at you live on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. It is a glorious sunny day. We are eating some delicious salads from Roberta's And I also want to welcome to the studio John Donahue, Man with a Pan, editor, author?
Editor.
Author, editor of Man with a Pan.
Author. Right.
A series of collections of Fathers Who Cook. And we're going to get to that just in a second. I just want to thank everybody who bought tickets to the Budokan Barbecue happening next Wednesday, more a week from Wednesday, on June 15th. We've sold out all of our pre-sales, and because of the response, we're going to add an additional about 150 plates at the door. So make sure you get there about 7. $10 gets you a drink from Reka Vodka and a plate of food, and the food is going to be delicious. Brian Ray, who was on Snacky Tunes a few weeks ago, will be there. You can listen to his episode, which is in our podcast. But John, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on the release of your book about 2 weeks ago, am I right?
That's correct.
So why don't you tell me a little about your book, Man with a Pan, who you are, how you got started, and your cooking as a father.
Well, I put together this collection called Man with a Pan. It's all about dads who cook for their families, because I'm a dad who cooks for my family. I have two young girls, and I started cooking for them back when they were born, and I was kind of surprised to find myself in that role, and I looked around and I saw some of my dad friends who were my age cooking as well, and I realized no one had told the stories about the guys who cook, and I wanted to be that guy.
Now, when you first had your first child, mm-hmm. You were still going out to restaurants, and you said, and in your book you say it wasn't really until your second child came along that you really started looking around and thinking about the value of eating out and what you were actually eating versus cooking at home.
Well, it all kind of happens in a blur. So, you know, first child, second child, it's hard to keep it all straight. But what happened was when we had our first child, I don't know, it's a profound shift that everybody mentions. And somehow I dealt with the kind of panic and anxiety and joy by going into the kitchen and cooking a lot.
Does your wife cook?
She does. She bakes. Primarily, I think that's her preference, and she does a fair amount of cooking, but she works, and you know, she didn't want to make the food for the family, and so I took over that role.
So let's go back to your childhood and talk about how you ramped up to you being at home cook, chef. What would you say?
I'm a home cook. Chef is a little elaborate, you know. I like to make the food I make at home. I call rustic cuisine because with kids running around, I don't really get to chop the carrots as small as I might like.
And right, you're not having squirt bottles and doing plate wipes.
Right,
and
yeah, we're approaching. You know, we hope to ascend to a level of elegance someday, but at the moment, it's all about flavor and sustenance.
So, when you were a child, did your mother or your father cook?
Oh, well, just my mom. I grew up in a very traditional household. My father worked. I had four brothers and sisters, and my mom was home taking care of us.
And your college lean bachelor days, were you cooking then? When did you first start getting into the kitchen?
I worked in a retail fish market in high school and college, and then for a year after, and have always been interested in food for a fundamental reason. I've always been very hungry somehow. I'm really kind of tall and skinny and starving, and so I was always attracted to working around food. And when I worked at the fish market, some of the people who were on staff with me were graduates of the CIA. And there was a little kitchen there. We made some prepared foods. And I learned some, you know, nice sauteing techniques. I learned some fundamentals about food preparation. And then was able to, you know, always translate those into making meals for myself or making meals for my friends.
Right. So you get married. You have kids. You have your second kids. You start cooking for yourself. And beyond just getting some, you know, reward out of that, you found that it actually improved, I would say, your marital relations, as you say in your book?
Well, I think, you know, everybody's marriage is different. I've always been very satisfied with the state of my marital relations. But there are certain statistics that come up. I think what you're alluding to is what's mentioned in the introduction.
Yes.
It has been discovered by some eminent sociologists that the more work a man does around the house, the better reported level of sexual satisfaction there is in a couple. And so
I guess maybe not all the energy is spent on cooking and cleaning, and right, some of it's left over at the end of the day.
Well, if you think about the, you know, men's energy levels tend to be very elastic and around certain activities, and they may not tire out in a way that their partner might.
Right. I think, are you picking up?
I think I get it.
You think you get it. So now, you know, it's interesting because cooking has always had these two sort of gender stereotypes, you know, growing up or, you know, in the 50s or 60s or 70s or even 80s, like cooking at home was a woman's job. Right. Stereotypically.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and, that's the history.
In the kitchen, especially, you know, in France, I think that it was always like a very man, like when you went out. Mm-hmm. And now that you've said, I think in your book, the shift has been from, I think, a 5% at home male cooking ratio to now a third at home of men who cook.
Roughly, yeah. When you look at how much time is spent, how much time a family spends putting together meals at home.
What do you think that shift is? Do you think it? Why has that occurred?
Well, I think if you have to look at the kind of bigger picture and what's happened as in our society over the last generation, where more women have gone back into the or have gone into the workforce in tremendous numbers. In fact, women outnumber men in the workforce right now because of the recession for the first time ever in history. So if we take what you're saying as face value, and I think you're right about the past, it was always a woman's job. And those women are off doing other jobs. That means no one's really doing that job. And there's very little home cooking being done. And men have had a chance to kind of step into the void. And what I think men don't really realize is the kind of fun it is and the immediate gratification you can get and the satisfaction you can get out of doing it.
Oh, I mean, I think as two guys who cook sitting alongside you in the studio, there's few things that I really do enjoy more than cooking for people that I really care about.
Right. I agree.
Yeah. I really think especially when you do something like a 3 or 4 hour, like a slow or 8 hour, like slow roasted meat or, like a cassoulet or something like that, to know that you put in those hours and then to see people's faces light up and things like that.
It's a really amazing experience. And the sort of dirty little secret about cooking, from my perspective, is that it's not actually that complicated.
No.
You talk about a 3 hour cassoulet and it sounds like, I don't know, you're doing the next moonshot or something. But you know what? It's really not. It's more like, you know, building a model airplane when you were a kid.
I mean, it a lot of the things, and I guess this is the irony, that it's a matter of time, which is not quite the luxury that you have as a new parent.
Well, when you're a new parent, or when you're a parent, period, you lose, you don't have any time. And then it becomes more of a kind of a logistical question and a kind of organizational question. And that's the that's where it gets complicated as a parent. It's always been a drag to be the home cook, man or woman. And that's one of the reasons I think women rebelled against it for years. There was a famous cookbook in the 60s called I Hate Cooking, I think it was, by Peggy someone. Anyway, it was a collection of simple recipes and about opening cans and such. And it's hard to cook for a family day in, day out.
There is. It is. And it's also hard. And, you know, things like these recipes that I've really responded to is that a lot of times people think that this would just apply to people's family, but a lot of times young professionals or people on the go really are craving good gourmet but easy to prepare recipes, and something like, you know, the recipes in Man with a Pan have that same sort of allure.
Sure, yeah. A lot of the recipes in the book are geared towards the, you know, kind of harried dad who's in a hurry and stuff, but there's other more elaborate things in there, and there's something for everyone. Of course, when you're young and single, you have other reasons to cook.
Yes. And would you say that the main tip is organization? Would you say?
Oh, I think so. There was this a U.S. general named Omar Bradley in the Second World War who had this saying that amateurs discuss strategy and professionals discuss logistics. And it's really, if you want to win the war, you want to get it done, you got to get the food from the store to the refrigerator to the stove to the plate, and that takes foresight and planning.
And who does the dishes?
Well, whoever's around.
It's not like a I cook, you clean type of...
Well, it can be. I mean, every relationship is different. You know? There's probably people who enjoy doing dishes.
All right.
Well, that's one little tip for if you want a tip for cooking with kids, especially young kids. You can get them to wash the vegetables, and they will just... They love playing with water. They'll stand at the kitchen sink and they'll have a good time washing the beans and washing that asparagus, and it'll never be cleaner ever.
So we're going to take a quick musical break. We're going to come back and talk about, I mean, you have some really great people, Man with the Pan, Stephen King, Mario Batali, Mark Bittman, and just amazing people in this book we're going to talk to. And one of the people you have is John Wesley Harding, who is both a musician and a novelist and an essayist. And
under his given name, which is Wesley Stace.
But we actually have a track of his, If You Have Ghosts, which we're going to play, and then we're going to come back and talk more with John Donahue and his collection of essays of Fathers Who Cook, Man with a Pan. You're listening to Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.com. Thanks for listening. right. That was just John Wesley Harding, If You Have Ghosts. I think it's a Rocky Erickson cover, but I could be wrong. Anyway, the reason why I play that song is because he is one of the contributors in John Donahue's great essay book, Man with a Pan, about fathers who cook. John?
Yeah, we have Wesley Stace in there. We have a lot of folks. We have Mark Bittman, Mario Batali, Mark Kurlansky, Jim Harrison. It was a great pleasure to work with Wesley Stace. He's a whole lot of fun to get to know. And that was one of the pleasures of the book, meeting all these other dads and writers who cook.
So let's go back a little bit, because we've actually never dealt with a... we've never had an editor on who did a collection of essays. We've had people who've written cookbooks or people who've written their own books. So you have this idea about fathers who cook, and a very specific genre.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you go from just having that idea to research to actually getting... Stephen King is, you know, he's a really notable guy. He's busy. It's not like these guys are just sitting around waiting for a phone call to write.
Well, absolutely. It's, I had this idea about wanting to do a book about guys who cook, essentially, because I was cooking myself, as I said before, for my daughters. And what I realized is that it's a really varied experience. Every family is different. Every dad is different. They all approach it differently. And I wanted to get a bunch of different voices into kind of capture the totality of that experience. And that's why I thought of an anthology. And I work in publishing, so I, you know who to talk to reach certain people. And what I discovered when I approached a given writer about the project, that if they were in the least bit interested, they were wildly enthusiastic. So they just wanted to tell their stories.
When you start getting these stories, do you find that these men have been waiting to talk about their cooking for their families? Had they been waiting for someone to ask them? It's like, this is what I'm doing for my family.
Well, I think in a way, not consciously perhaps, but Mark Kurlansky is a good example. I admired his writing a lot. I knew that he knows a lot about cooking, and I thought he'd be a great person for the book. So I figured out how to get in touch with him, and I called him up, and he listened to my pitch, and he said, wow, you know, that's interesting. I'll think about it. And it occurs to me that I don't think he's in his 60s. He says, I've never actually thought about this before, but I've never been involved with a woman who could cook. Hmm. And I don't really know what that means, and I'd like to think about that. So he set him off on he was happy to write the essay. And to put the book together, I kind of envisioned short pieces by all the writers, about 1,500 words, which is, I don't know, 5 pages or so, 10 pages. It's short. And I got 5,000-word pieces, perfectly formed pieces from some of the writers. They just really wanted to run with it.
Wow.
And they were happy to do so.
So then what's the process? So you get these essays in. Did you do a lot of editing? Did you work with them?
I did. You know, some people need more, or some people embrace the editing process more than others. And I wanted to preserve everybody's voice. So we have Jack Hitt talking about basically red beans and the history of Southern race relations in his essay. And we have Stephen King talking about how his wife lost her sense of taste because she was living near a toxic well, and how he took over the cooking, and how he just likes to make simple dishes. And so everybody had a different voice and different point of view, and I wanted to preserve that. I just work with them to be clear in their storytelling and help them get their point across.
So what are some of the highlights from the book that you found related to your life as well? Did you find that in talking to other fathers that there were parallels between your experience cooking for your daughters and their lives?
Oh, certainly, because a lot of the being a father who cooks, a lot of it comes out of, you know, just the commonality of being a father and having to deal with the family, the pressure on time. For example, when you become a parent, your time just kind of vanishes and disappears, and there's that commonality, but also there's some differences. I talked to a football coach in Atlanta who cooks for his family, and he had a kind of funny story. He's in the book, and he had a funny story about how he got started. His wife, he and his wife got married, and she was doing the cooking for a while, and I guess there was some issues with the flavor and the taste, and having to have Mylanta in the medicine cabinet and such. And they had a little heart to heart about 2 years in, and he took over cooking. And he has a very high stress job. He's a guidance counselor and a football coach at a high school in Atlanta. And a couple of times we had to reschedule the interview with him because he was dealing with student crises, included, you know, somebody getting murdered or being in jail. And, you know, he had a really serious job and doing really serious work, and still finding the time to take care of his family and do the cooking. And so he told me he does the cooking at a 24-hour grocery store at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, wow, you're really short of time, you know, like you're working a really long day there. And he said, no, I could do it in the afternoon. But if I do it in the afternoon, a 1 hour shopping trip will turn into a 3 hour trip because I'll run into some parent from the school and they'll want to talk to me about their kid.
Right.
So he goes in the middle of the morning to avoid other parents, basically.
I think the great thing about this book is that not all of these are success stories. And that's the other thing that you have to understand about cooking is that there are going to be times when you're putting out 7 to 21 meals a week that they're not all going to be winners.
Oh, absolutely.
And can you talk to me about maybe one or two of your own dishes that came short of pleasing the family?
Oh, well, my kind of most notorious one around my household involved my first foray into making pizza. And it's kind of ironic. We're here at Roberta's and we're sitting in front of two
delicious
lovely pies that are tempting us. And so I went and I got a recipe from the Times and I got a pizza stone and I got the San Marzano tomatoes and I got everything. And the kids, they love me and they're very excited. And every kid loves pizza. My kids are no different. So they're very excited about the pizza and take up all afternoon making pizza and comes out and it's not exactly burned, but you know, it's got weird bits of tomato on it and stuff, and the kids won't eat the pizzas. So it's like, you know, if your kids can't eat your own pizza, I should probably throw in the towel, but you have to persevere.
And have you gotten your kids involved in it beyond just washing? I mean, I know they're still really young, but at what age are you going to let them start wielding a knife and really getting in the dirtiness of the
pizza? We live in an apartment in Brooklyn, and there's not that much space in the kitchen, and in particular the apartment we used to live in for a while. So they're always around. They like to be around me. I'm their father and they adore me and I like to have them around me. So they're there and I let them use knives, maybe not very sharp knives, but I'm not afraid of them being in the kitchen or around the hot stove. They learn pretty quickly to stay away from the hot stuff. And they like to be involved. And my eldest daughter, really, she's taken a shine to setting the table and making little place cards and doing all that stuff on her own, and I'm happy to let her run with that.
Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Sure.
Man with the Pans out of Algonquin, perfect for Father's Day and beyond Father's Day if you just want some good essays and things like that. Anything else you would like to add? Any Twitter and website and all that?
Well, I have a blog. It's called stayatstovedad.com, where I talk to other fathers who cook for their family and write about the cooking I do for my own, and I'm on Twitter at @StayAtStoveDad, and you can follow me there.
And any events coming up? Any chance people can meet you in person?
Nothing planned at the moment, but I'm sure we'll be doing something soon.
Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I look forward to you sticking around. We'll be ripping into these pizzas in just a moment. And also coming up, we're going to have Travis Hayden, one of our best bros, who is back a year later from when we last had him on the show to talk about his new venture, Our Label, and the shift from working at a major record label to his own, right?
That's right.
That's right.
Can't
okay.
Wait.
Well, here we go. We're going to do a quick two-song set of two of our favorite songs so far this summer. Travis, I know you can guess which one of them is, along with anyone else who has been friends with me for like the last month. This is Snacky Tunes on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. It's a beautiful day and also not a bad day to spend in the kitchen. Here we go. Take these shackles off of me.
we dream. It's all that matters. We're on our way, united. Turn the crowd up now. We'll never back down. Shoot down a skyline. Watch it on prime time. Turn up the love now. Listen up now. Turn up the love. Who's gonna save the world tonight? Who's gonna bring it back to life? We're gonna make it, you and I. We're gonna save the world
Oh my God, if that isn't the song of the summer, Swedish House Mafia, Save the World Tonight, and before that was Prisoner of Love from Jessica Six, some of our favorite people. And we play those songs in honor of one of our best friends, Travis Hayden. Hello, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Back.
Again, yes. A year later.
It's actually almost a year later to the day.
Yeah, last time I was in, we were talking about me going to Ibiza for a music conference.
Ibiza? That's IBT47Hs.
Yep.
A. So, and also last time you were working for Big Beat, which was the giant music division of Atlantic, the dance version.
Yeah, I was running Big Beat Records. I'd just been brought on maybe 6 months later to run all the dance music at Atlantic Records. And since then I've left. I'm still there in an A&R capacity, but full time, I have my own management company.
Which is called?
Nothing.
Travis Hayden, Awesome Town?
On the checks, it's Hayden Music Management.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't really ring a
bell. Yeah.
Yeah. But more importantly, you've launched your own, and which is now your second music label.
Yeah, it is. I started off my introduction to the music industry was starting a label called iHeartComics.
Mm-hmm.
Madden Kim, Hearts Revolution, Toxic Avenger, Designer Drugs, and numerous others.
Totally Michael.
Protocol.
And now you're focused more on just straight up dance music.
Yeah, there's no real format to the label. I mean, one thing that's nice right now with starting a record label being so accessible for anyone is I can avoid format and genre and just put out music that I enjoy.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes most of it is dance or electronic oriented, but a lot of it leans to the pop side, but not so much as commodity pop.
Right, right, right. So let's talk about the transition. So you leave working for the major with the idea that you're going to start your own label. It wasn't just like you left and you're like, what am I going to do, right?
Right. And I support myself on music management, and this digital label is purely a passion project. I went into it knowing that that's what it was going to be. And luckily I had experience that I knew the worst thing that could happen was I would break even. Like,
that's the worst.
That's the worst.
Isn't the worst losing a ton of money?
Yeah. I mean, but I knew I played my cards right and I had experience to do this, I knew I could sell some music or get some of the songs in TV commercials or films and make some money back. But, you know, as soon as I left, I was just inundated with music. It came out of nowhere. Maybe it was there. It was just, it didn't fit the format for the major label dance.
Right. So you have, you know, like 100 songs that you'd love to put out, but it's just not right for the label you're working for.
Yeah. So I did have a cachet of music where it didn't really click until I left. And I was like, oh, I can put this out.
All right. So how about this? Who have you put out?
Right now, I've put out Punches. Are you familiar with them?
I'm familiar with those awesome dudes of Punches.
And then also, I'm a digital distributor for other labels for people who've started their labels and they don't necessarily know how to distribute their music and don't want to go through the channels and don't want to just deal with the process, and they can go through me. And one of the labels that's been most successful is called The Pop Manifesto.
Oh yeah, love those guys.
You know, with releases by Blood Diamonds, Magic Mountain, and a few others.
All right, so let's play a song. What do you have queued up?
This is a new release. We opened the show with Narcisse with one of their singles, but this one is the follow-up single, which has never been played on the radio before. And I really like it.
You're testing me and looking in my eyes. If this ain't it, then all the movies lie.
All right. That was just Narcisse?
Yeah, that's a new track that'll be out later this summer. They're a local Brooklyn group.
Yeah, they're awesome. Yeah. One of the guys works at Pies and Thighs, doesn't he?
He does. We signed our recording agreements at Pies and Thighs.
Amazing. Food and music together forever.
Consummated the marriage with a chicken biscuit.
Yeah, you did.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about how your career trajectory has actually reflected the overall shift in music and genre and things like that, and about moving away from major labels and opening up independent labels.
The great thing now that hasn't really existed before is an accessible means of distribution. Pretty much anyone who wants to put out a song, whether it's an artist or kid in a bedroom or someone who already exists in the music industry like myself, can find a means of distribution for nothing. There's no requirements necessary. It's just music. From digital distributors, from InGrooves to IOTA, and even TuneCore, where you can just upload essentially straight to iTunes. It's an accessibility that's never existed before. And so you're seeing a flood of new music, new emerging genres. It's allowing people who necessarily wouldn't be able to get in there in the past to really jump in and be a part of it. The thing that I do like about it is there's a lot more passion involved in it. It's people that are really excited, but think, I want to put out this song, and it's less commodity based. I mean, it is a business and we try and make money and try and make a living off of it, but that commodity aspect of it is fading away with independent labels. And there have been really great independent labels for a very long time.
Oh, yeah. But mostly indie rock.
Yeah. You know.
When you associate, I mean, there have been underground dance labels, but it's been most, Merge and 4AD and things like
that.
Yeah,
XL. You know.
So how do you cut through the ever-growing, ever-increasing number of songs that are out there? How do you get something to go viral?
Well, I mean, When I find music that I want to release, that's not what I necessarily think of. I hear a great song and I say, I love this. I want to put this out. Everything beyond that, releasing it. I mean, there are people, kids who have started their own labels and just released a song that has gone out of control. I mean, Young Turks with the XX. I mean,
oh yeah,
they're not just kids, but
no.
But I mean, the success that record saw, it's
insane.
Yeah.
So even if you look at Barbara Streisand,
yeah,
which is on Fool's Gold, who we had on last week. I mean, that song is massive. A monster hit.
Massive.
And it just struck the right chord at the right time.
Yeah, and it comes down to resources. Mm-hmm. Now that I've been working in this for quite a while, I don't have a lot of money, but I know a tremendous amount of people and like-minded individuals. I know who to give the music to, for film and television, for radio, for blogging. So a lot of this stuff I can handle on my own. I don't have to hire too much to run a label. It's publicity, some marketing, sometimes radio, but I don't need a building with 200 people in it to get this out to the people. And sometimes I have the same ending when I release one of my tracks as some major labels that where it's their flop, but I'm like, well, this is a very marginal success to me, but I put in a quarter of the energy and a
resources,
20th of the money to do this. So that playing field is the nice thing to me. It's enjoyable. Like, I love seeing an 18-year-old kid, or like I find a new label on Beatport or iTunes, like this great stock of music. I'm like, well, who is this? I'm going to look this up and talk to these kids and see what they're doing. Maybe I can help them. I can pull them into my label and find out it's a 17 or 18-year-old kid in Oklahoma.
Right.
He's like, I don't know what I'm doing. I just upload this and send it to my friends.
Right. And it goes viral. And Speaking of viral, the next track that you're going to play from us is from one of your artists, Gigamesh,
yep.
who used the double rainbow clip.
Yes. And
you had to clear that, right?
Yes. So he turned over his EP to me, which will be released on my label, our label. I'm going through the music, and I didn't hear the demos or anything, and I'm going through it, and I'm like, this sounds really familiar. This is a bit after the Double Rainbow video had come out, and all of a sudden we have to clear this sample. And so it was a strange process of looking up, trying to track down the Double Rainbow guy, whose name is Bear, tracking him down, talking to him, negotiating with the man, and getting a letter and clearing the sample.
Which you did.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to listen to this Gigamesh. It's So Intense.
Yes.
Coming out on our label this summer.
Summer, yep.
Awesome. All right, here we go. Travis Hayden, our label, International.
International.
Which we'll get to in just a minute.
Yeah, that's a story.
Here we go.
We'll be right back.
All right, that was just Gigamish from Our Label International on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. And we're here with Travis Hayden, who runs Our Label International. And talk to us about how you find an artist like Gigamish, who's just a fantastic talent.
Well, Gigamish was interesting. I was managing, and still am, a group called Senior Stereo out of Miami. And Gigamish was a part of that. I had heard about him, but when I started managing Senior Stereo, they told me the only way that you can manage us is if you manage this guy, Gigamish. And I was like, okay. And so I set up a call with him, just one-on-one, sent me music, and I knew his remixes. And shortly after, actually, he had produced a song for Mike Posner called Cooler Than Me. Mm-hmm. I didn't know this, and I had just started managing him, and I was flipping through this Billboard magazine that I was in from that trip to Ibiza.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And I'm flipping through it, and it's Gigamish's name in huge print, and he produced a song that sold 2.5 million copies, and I was like, well, if this is serendipitous, if it's not, I don't know what is. And so
I can see you sitting in the magazine going, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but he's a great producer, and his own music is really fantastic. And, you know, shortly after all of that, he sent me this EP, and I was just floored. You know, I am managing him as well. So he's a great producer and writer, working with a whole bunch of different artists. And, you know, he has this EP coming out this summer that we're touring on. We'll be touring all over the U.S. and Europe, Australia. And so it's been a really exciting process to be on both sides of that. Mm-hmm. But the EP is really great. It's coming out this summer, and I'm very excited for it.
So let's talk about the name, Our Label, which you had recently changed to Our Label International, and the story of what happened there.
Well,
and the importance of picking a name, because Our Label is not the most Googleable.
No, I always joke about that. It was like, at first you Google Our Label and nothing comes up. It's those kids that I was talking about that start their own labels.
Yeah.
And on blogs they say, I'm putting it out on Our Label. And so I just canceled the Google alerts on that. It was like too much. But once you put in Our Label Records, there is a funk kind of reggaeton label based out of the UK. And I got an email saying,
what's up?
Yeah.
Hey,
our labels have the same name.
What are we going to do about it?
Yeah, and, you know, it was I'm pretty laid back about it. I mean, I was like, look, I don't want any ambiguity here. Let me just add a little bit to the name and separation. They don't release that frequently, so I just switched it up a little bit.
And Our Label International was born.
Yeah, it's fine. Got a new website.
Boom.
Yeah.
What's the website?
OurLabelintl.com.
Very nice. Very nice. So what do you have coming up this summer? What are you releasing? What are you putting out?
So I have a single by Panther Hands.
Uh-huh.
I have two singles by The Narcisse.
Mm-hmm.
I have an EP by Gigamish.
Mm-hmm.
I have an EP from this group from Brooklyn called Punches.
Yes, I've heard of those guys.
Yeah, and I have two Narcisse. Did I already say that?
Yeah.
Okay. Two Narcisse singles and an Ocelot single.
Love Ocelot.
Yeah, pretty good.
Corey, what's up, buddy?
Yeah. Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, Jamie. Shout out to you guys.
Jimmy.
Jimmy?
Jimmy.
What did I say? Jamie?
Yeah.
Jimmy.
Yeah.
Jimmy and Corey.
Yep.
So what are you going to take us out on? What are you going to play?
Well, let's play this never heard before Ocelot demo.
Which one?
It's untitled.
Oh, okay, great.
This is the one I'm putting out.
Okay.
This is a demo, so please don't rip it.
Yeah, please don't rip it. Anyway, so I'd like to thank my guest, John. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you to Roberta's for the pizza. Jack Inslee, Heritage, as always. Big shout out to DJ Never Forget, who is, I think, en route right now to New York City. And we'll be out and about at the Talents Week for Internet Week.
What?
We're going to go see Cold Cave tonight.
Can't wait.
And probably The Moth tomorrow. Big shout out to fellow other public broadcasters.
Yeah, Dan Kennedy.
Dan Kennedy at The Moth.
Thank you.
Thank you for hilarious stories about everything and anything. We have a few things coming up. You know, we have the barbecue on June 15th at Good Company. We have 150 tickets at the door. Greg and I will be DJing. I'm sorry, DJ didn't forget. And I will be DJing at the Barbary in Philadelphia June 13th, June 24th. And we have a Death and Taxes thing. And we have a few other big announcements coming up for some other shows. Travis, John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. A beef cut has been designed for a beer pairing. I know you're all going to be really happy to hear that. The Samuel Adams Boston Lager Cut will be available nationwide through an online retailer. This was actually designed by Jake Dixon of New York City's Dixon's Farm Stand Meats, located in the Chelsea Market, and it's cut from the cap to the top sirloin at a 45-degree angle. It's a nice-looking little steak. It's an 8-ounce steak that is designed to complement Sam Adams Boston Lager. But I bet you could find other beers that it would pair well with as well. So look out for it. Let's see what it's like. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.